Good evening, everyone. We're going to get started. I want to thank everyone for coming out on a untypical, actually, Minnesota evening in late October. We're usually enjoying the wonderful fall colors and cool fall breezes and certainly much more drier weather, but instead we've become Seattle over the course of the last month or so, and so we can now empathize with our brothers and sisters out on the West Coast. But thank you for coming. This is a joint hearing of the Early Childhood Education Policy and Finance Division, the K-12 Education Finance Division, and the K-12 Education Policy and Oversight Committees of the House. And my name is Carlos Mariani. I have the privilege of chairing the K-12 Education Policy Committee. And what I will do very shortly is I'll just go around the table very quickly and have members introduce themselves. Tonight's hearing is perhaps the first of a couple of hearings between now and the beginning of a session relative to the federal Race to the Top opportunity grants that are a part of the recent federal government's investment in K-12 education, extending out through the ARA. What does ARA stand for again? The American. That'll be a test for everyone at the Center of Garofalo's. So it's Center of the Stimulus Funds. And so what we want to be able to do today is to engage in a public way what Race to the Top, very quickly, to understand what the Race to the Top framework and proposals, or rather framework looks like, and then to engage with our Department of Education in terms of what the emerging proposal is, or what the proposal is emerging from the state of Minnesota in response to Race to the Top. And some of the things that I'm particularly interested in, and I also would want to hear from members here, are things like ensuring that whatever comes from the state of Minnesota, because this is really, a historic major and perhaps one-shot opportunity to be able to attract some pretty sizable investments in our state to help continue Minnesota's proud tradition of reforming its and pushing and innovating its K-12 schools. But one of the things that I'm interested in then is to be able to ensure that Minnesotans own whatever it is that its state government is proposing to do with these new resources. And so part of what I want to be able to do at this hearing is to spend some time getting a sense from members of the House about that ownership process. I also think that there are some, it's easy for us to sort of think about immediate short-term possibilities, and I can get excited about those, but I'm sure my colleagues here around the table will share the sentiment that whatever it is that gets proposed, eventually the legislature is going to be asked to own this. And owning it also means being able to own the policy that emanates from it and to feed that policy, but then also own the level of public investments that can make this work over the long haul. And so I want us to at least begin to have that discussion and engage with our presenters here today along those issues. And so before we get into the presenters, let me just do a couple of very quick acknowledgments. We have representatives from several of our congressional, Minnesota congressional delegation present with us today. I believe we have someone from Senator Klobuchar's office, so perhaps if you can just wave a hand.
Right,
and there you go. And I believe you're Joe Campbell, is that correct?
Yep.
Very good. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
We have someone from Senator Al Franken's office. That's Amy.
Hi.
How are you, Amy Hang, right? Very good. Congresswoman McCollum's office. Chow, where's my good friend Chow? We've been together half the day today, Mr. Lee, Charles Lee. Good to see you again. And then we also have someone from Congress, Keith Ellison's office. Very good. Trishana, I have your first name, but not your last.
Thomas.
Trishana Thomas. Welcome. Welcome to you all. Thank you. Obviously, it's important that our congressional delegation have a strong sense of what the state is proposing relative to the use of these federal funds, and that you also have a strong sense of how the legislature is responding to that. It is, my sad observation, and I don't want to put a downer on this, but it is my sad observation that the Race to the Top framework does not involve a formal role for state legislators anywhere in the country. And so across the country, as our states are looking to attract this level and this kind of investment into their states, there is a little bit of angst among our colleagues across the states for the reasons I mentioned earlier about, you know, the long-term applicability of whatever comes out of our State Department of Education. So it's very important that we have these hearings in order to fully flesh out what the emerging thoughts are in regards to K-12 reform of our state. And so it's very important that our congressional delegation get to sit in and hear how their state legislators are responding to the emerging proposal. We will begin the hearing after we do the introductions here by hearing from Mr. David Shrev of the National Council of State Legislators, who will give us a brief overview of Race to the Top and offer some advice on what the potential transformative benefits as well as the potential transformative pitfalls might be relative to Race to the Top. We will then move into a discussion with the Department of Education. I spoke with our commissioner earlier today. She wanted to be here. She is sick, and I confirmed that by talking to her on the phone. She sounded terrible. So our well wishes are with Alice. We hope that Commissioner Siegman gets well soon, but we do have Assistant Commissioner Karen Clinton. Good to see you, Karen. So we'll be engaging with you and your staff after we hear from Mr. Shrev. And then we do have a number of associations in K-12 that are going to come forward and offer some very quick thoughts and advice. And then hopefully, if there's time, I know that we have several people from different communities present. We hope to be able to get your thoughts in as well. So with that, I'm going to start by going to my left, my good colleague.
Mindy Greiling.
And Mindy, you have to tell the public more, a little bit more than that.
Okay, I'm the chair of the K-12 Education Finance Committee, and we are more than likely going to have a part two hearing that I will be chairing. And so if people don't get all their questions or input in, then we'll have another opportunity further along the road when we know more, when we get the real regulations from the federal government.
Thank you.
Pat Garofalo, and I'm just happy because this is the largest group of legislators I've seen this year that's not running for governor.
That's the only reason I'm here. I'm John Benson. I represent three school districts in Johnson, Hopkins, and Wayzata schools, and so I'm very interested, having been an educator myself.
I'm Representative Marcia Swales from Woodbury, and I am a teacher at Woodbury High School as well, and I'm very glad to be here and see my colleagues again. It's good to see you.
I'm Robin Brown. I represent the Albert Way area, southern Minnesota. I'm also a teacher, and it's good to get here and have a discussion about education.
I'm Representative Bob Detmer, District 52A, retired educator. And I represent three districts, Forest Lakes and Tenuan White Bear Lake.
I'm Mike Overmuller. I represent Eagan, and I have three school districts as well. But the kids live in Eagan, but there's an Integral Heights school district, the Burnsville school district, and Eagan, District 196 primarily.
And Representative Dietrich.
Good evening. I'm Representative Dietrich. I represent District 47A, which includes Champlin and Coon Rapids, which is singularly the Anoka-Hennepin School District. which, in case anybody doesn't know, is the largest school district.
We were about to ask.
And I'm Carolyn Lane, representing Columbia Heights, Fidley, financing area. I've been on a school board and teacher.
Representative Jim Dabney, I represent part of Minneapolis, and I'm a former teacher.
Hi, I'm Paul Anderson, District 13A, rural area between approximately St. Cloud and Alexandria. Too wet to combine, unfortunately. And I think there are about 9 school districts that all are part in my legislative district.
Good evening. Representative Corey Capps, represent Owatonna and Waseca Public Schools, and I am also Vice Chair of K-12 Education Policy.
I'm Paul Rosenthal. I represent Bloomington and Edina, and 2 young children, a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, so I'm very interested in this, and I'm also the Vice Chair of the Early Childhood Committee.
Thank you, members, and we will introduce others as they do come in. Let me just encourage you all. I'm hoping that this will be really a discussion, and so if you hear things from any of our presenters, don't hesitate to get my attention and we'll cut right in. So that's also a notice to our presenters that we'll probably be cutting in quite often. But I think for the nature of this hearing, I think it's really important that we really move into discussion mode, as a powerful discussion mode as our methodology. So, Mr. Shred, thank you for coming. If you can perhaps just identify yourself, tell us who you are, and sure. And then when we're in your hands with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Shreve. I'm David Shreve.
I'm sorry.
From the National Conference of State Legislatures Washington office. I work on federal affairs related to education, and I've worked in that position for 12 years. In addition to 8 years before that, I worked at NTSL on some vocational education job training issues, and then moved into the K-12 education business.
Welcome to Minnesota.
Well, thank you. I left a cold and gray and dreary Washington to come to a cold and gray and dreary Minnesota.
We do what we can.
Well, I felt right at home. What I'm going to do today is talk about race to the top, and I'm going to try and race through some of these slides because they really just provide you an overview of what we're talking about in regard to the race to the top monies and funds and activities. So please feel free to stop me if I'm going too fast and to give me one of these if I need to speed it up a little bit. This was originally written in response as an outline of the regulatory process for the race to the top. What is the race to the top? Well, it's a almost $5 billion grant fund that was in the Stimulus Act that was designed to encourage and reward states that are creating the conditions for innovation and reform. In the initial commitment, the department and the administration have made it clear that their first round of grants is going to be to about 15 states, and the grant range will be up between $200 and $500 million. Certainly not an insignificant amount on face value, but probably more insignificant when you look at it as a percentage of the whole. $4.3 billion is about 0.7% of the entire K-12 budget for 1 year, so it's not a lot of money in aggregate, but it certainly is enough money to do some things that you may be wanting to do. In order to understand the race to the top, you have to understand the stimulus money, or the ARRA money. And I tell you the truth, I have a hard time remembering what it stands for, too. So I usually call it ARRA and think of a pirate with a parrot on his shoulder. And then I don't have to explain what it actually means. So in order to understand this, you first have to look at the budget conditions in the states. I know you don't have to be told this, but they're miserable. Between the yellow states on this map and the blue states on this map, you have an indication of 35 states that have budget gaps of between 10 and 20%, significant in anybody's mind. And this slide just gives an idea of the extent that spending cuts have been used to close those budget gaps in the various states. So in the case of California, they use budget cuts to close 48% of their gaps. Here in Minnesota, 23%, and various and sundry states around the country. In Montana, they were able to cut their budget by 100% and close the gap by 100%. So they didn't need additional money. However, this slide shows how much people have used the stimulus funds, the ARRA funds, to close their budget gaps. So, for instance, in Texas, they used ARRA funds to cover 96% almost the entire budget gap that they had for the year, fiscal year 2010. And in Minnesota, used, according to the reports that we got, about 30% of the budget closing the gap was the result of using the stimulus funds. So basically, what we've seen is that, I'll show you this a little again, what we've seen is that the stimulus has been very successful at keeping state budgets afloat and then keeping education budgets afloat. But the states are facing a cliff once the federal stimulus money ends, which will be in shortly another year or so. And state governments are going to face another budgetary problem about 12 to 24 months after the U.S. recession ends. We call that the second cliff, the state cliff, because state budgets tend to bottom out somewhere around 18 months after the federal budget bottoms out. I know that's not good news to hear for you in the states, but things are going to get worse in most states before they get better, and they're still getting bad. Of course, this is going to test state legislators' endurance to deal with these issues. So in summary, this is where we are in budget. And to make it even easier, this is what happens when the federal stimulus money runs out. You're jumping off a cliff because you're losing that federal money. But then you have to jump off the cliff again another 16 or 18 months later when the state budgets bottom out and we're still facing some serious budget cuts and budget gaps. So, as I said, the stimulus really has done a lot to support state education budgets. But I think in a way that's been oversold, it's been quoted as saying that it lays the foundation for education reform by supporting investments and innovative strategies, and that ARRA has basically moved the ship of education reform along on its passage. Unfortunately, even the domestic policy councils, the White House, the GAO, have really focused on the stimulus saving job and have not really come up with any examples of the stimulus leveraging school reform, especially on a statewide basis. You may see examples of it in schools and in districts, but certainly you've seen no concerted efforts by a state to use stimulus funds to leverage long-term school reform. We've been using the ARRA funds to tread water. Now, for those of you who know anything about treading water, anybody that's been in the pool, in the lake, or in the ocean, when you're treading water, it's really hard to learn a new stroke. And I think that's the way I like to keep it in mind with the use of the stimulus funds. The stimulus funds have kept us afloat, and in so doing, it's solidified state budgets and education budgets. But nobody's really learned how to do the backstroke while they were trying to learn how to keep their head above water by treading water. Another way to look at it, I'm big on pictures, by the way, I should have warned you in advance. I don't know if anybody remembers these things. They were these aqua cars built in the 60s, and you could ride them down the street and on an off-ramp into a lake, and they turn into a boat. Yes. They were really cool. I mean, for a kid growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was just too cool for me to believe. I always wanted one of these things. Well, it turns out that the aqua car wasn't much of a car because it was too much like a boat, and it wasn't much of a boat because it was too much like a car. So it was a compromise that did neither thing very well, but did both things. It's another way of looking at the use of stimulus funds in this country. Stimulus funds have done a very good job, again, at keeping us afloat. They haven't done a very good job, or a moderately successful job, even, for leveraging school reform. So enough with the pictures. Let's get into the real stuff that's going to put you to sleep. Here are the regs and the reg sites for the stimulus fund. And this section of the stimulus fund outlines the guidelines for eligibility for these Race to the Top funds. the areas that are going to be looked at to evaluate your state race to the top funds are in the areas of standards and assessment, improving teacher effectiveness and achieving equity in teacher distribution, improving the use of data, the collection of data, supporting struggling schools. These are all identified in the Stimulus Act. And then some overall selection criteria, including some maintenance of effort for state and spending, which I'll get to in a second. So let's go through these individually. The first one is standards and assessment. In order to be favorably considered for the race to the top money, the state action, the state requirement, I'm sorry, the state application requires that states participate, endorse, and adopt the Common Standards Movement by June 2010 and ultimately adopt common assessments that the administration is pushing as well. Clearly, there are some concerns with this Common Standards and Movement and the involvement of the feds in common standards, common assessments, common curricula, and wherever else it may lead. I'll get back to that too. This is the first. The second item you're going to be looked at, that's going to be looked at when you your proposal is evaluated, is improving teacher effectiveness and achieving equity in teacher distribution, which would require also the alternative pathways for teacher and principal certification. It would require that you differentiate teacher performance evaluations and that you redistribute teachers to put highly effective teachers in very difficult schools where the learners are disadvantaged. This, too, brings some really significant overreach issues about the reach of the federal government, I think, in what they would require. When you hear the discussions at the federal level about something, especially about something like reassigning teachers, reassigning good teachers to poor districts, you really start to become suspicious of just how far can the federal government reach into the schools and tell you where to put the pieces and parts on the chessboard in order to achieve some kind of equity.
It would seem to me, Mr. Shree, that since we have different frameworks in different states, you know, some states are much more local control mm-hmm. in regards to delivery of K-12 instruction, and others are much more centralized. It would seem to me, just a quick initial read, particularly of this section, that for those states where you have a more central control culture may be in a better position to demonstrate this particular piece than states where the relationship between the legislature and the executive branch are almost negotiated, if you will, with, you know, hundreds of different school districts. Would you anticipate that what the federal government would be looking for here is demonstration of these elements via statutory action, strong statutory action, directive?
You really don't often see strong statutory action on the part of the feds. What you see in the case of a grant program like Title I is something called a condition of grant. Basically, they would tie it to your receipt of Title I dollars and say that as a condition of receiving Title I dollars, you had to do this, this, and this. And the enforcement level would be, from what the conversations I've heard thus far, the enforcement level would be at the local school district level, not at the state level, mm-hmm. because of the variation that you just described.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next item on the list of things that are going to be evaluated for your proposal have to do with longitudinal data systems, requiring the state to remove any barriers linking student test achievement and teacher evaluation. So it's clearly a preemption of state law as a condition, again, for getting your Title I dollars, which is the hook that the feds use to get you to comply with federal education law statutes. The fourth of these issues that you're going to be evaluated on is the concept of supporting and turning around struggling schools. Part of this area is demonstrated by proving that your charter school laws don't inhibit the number of charter schools in your state. So this would be the federal government telling you how many charter schools essentially is acceptable and whether or not your charter school law is too restrictive or not. Clearly, this is another issue of what we would consider a state right to determine the degree, the extent of charters and how the chartering process is done. But the federal government has already made it clear that they're going to take a pretty hard line on charter laws that basically restrict the number of charter schools in any state. And then finally,
I'm going to interrupt here. Representative,
Mr. Shreve, good evening. I'm just thinking these last three pieces that you've touched on, well, particularly the last two, I think, improving teacher effectiveness, three, the teacher effectiveness, the data collection and use for tying to student achievement, and the supporting struggling schools. The struggling schools, you focus on the charters, but when you say teachers, do you only mean the folks in the classroom, or does that also is there any mention of administrators? Are we looking at the licensure process for administrators? Are we looking at the role of an administrator in turning around a school? Are we looking at administrators and their use of data in leading and guiding instruction? Or is it really, are we really just talking about the person at the front of the classroom?
Mr. Shreve. It's really hard to tell at this point in time. In the race to the top, they've made it very clear that they're talking about teachers when they want to evaluate them according to student data, student achievement. When they're talking about alternative pathways, they specifically did mention teachers and administrators or leaders and principals. And there's another part of the federal law which I didn't come prepared to talk about tonight. It's some other state improvement grants that have talked about what to do when you restructure schools and at what level you restructure both the line staff of the teachers and the administrators that is within a particular school itself. So each one of these little pieces deals with a separate section of the endeavor, I would say. There's not one piece that deals specifically with all the teacher issues. And there's not one piece that deals with all the struggling school issues. It's sort of compartmentalized in the race to the top, and then in the other piece of Title I, which has to do with school improvement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Shreve, we have a question for Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shreve, I appreciate you being here. I appreciate the representatives from our federal elected officials' offices being here as well. And you've referenced a couple of times, you know, the state's rights and so forth. And I am always, when it comes to education, a state's rights person. We like Washington to send money, but we don't like too many strings. And I'm wondering if that conversation was had at the federal level in the table like this with the elected officials. Was this a jointly developed package with them, or did it come from the administration and was rubber stamped kind of in a euphoria for the money, or how much discussion was there on the very prescriptive mandates on what you have to do if you're going to qualify to be in the running for the few states that win?
The race to the top regulations are still being considered, but I have no reason to believe that they're going to make substantial changes to those race to the top provisions. And as you probably know, when it comes to the federal government, they tend to look at the state as the state education agency and not the legislature and not the governor, but their relationship is with the state agency, and they pretty much make it clear that the state agency will do their bidding if they want to see their money continue to come through the departments of education at the state level. There was not much discussion. We had some discussion with some high levels of the Department of Ed and the Obama administration to remind them of the critical role legislators play in developing policy and appropriating money. It didn't seem to make much difference to them because they seemed to have this idea fixed in their mind that they had these four areas that they thought were of major concern. And these four areas that we're talking about are the same areas that were supposed to be emphasized in the stimulus package and supposed to be testified to as being a part of the state's effort to spend stimulus money. These are the exact same four areas that they talked about in the ARRA funds that they're talking about in the race to the top. Now, to give you some idea of the comments that were came from as a result of the race to the top regulations, which again are still being looked at in Washington, in NCSL's response called this a top-down approach that had a one reform process for all 50 states. The National Education Association referred to this as conformity to one process. The American Federation of Teachers called it another level of top-down accountability on top of the faulty accountability procedures of ARRA. Council of Chief State School Officers pretty much echoed that a little bit more softly. The National School Boards Association complained that the race to the top funds are overly prescriptive and focused on emphasizing specific strategies for addressing underperforming schools. And even the Governors Association called question to the processes that we'll talk about in a few minutes. So I think it's pretty safe to say, and I'm not reading all of these comments because there's too many of them, but it's pretty safe to say that the education policy world in Washington was not really enamored and was not really consulted when it came to the development of the race to the top regs. And I hate to be cynical, but I don't expect much to change when the regs are finalized and come out in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
And, I was going to ask a question about the timing of that, but Mr. Shreve, my understanding is that we should have seen the guidelines by now, but apparently they have not yet been issued. And my further understanding is that I think under federal law, you have to allow a 60-day period of time in order to be able to respond to those kind of guidelines. And so originally, we were thinking that the state of Minnesota would be issuing a proposal for December 1st guideline, but now it's starting to look like perhaps closer to the beginning of the year.
They're saying late this year.
Okay.
For a deadline. Now, the comment period for the regs is over, and the phase we're in now is the department is supposedly evaluating the comments that they got and that they will somehow or other take action upon them. I think, as I recall, they got something like 3,000 comments. I was focused more on the critical ones because we were relatively critical about this. But again, the education policy world and most of the governance organizations in Washington expressed pretty strong concerns about this being another top-down federal effort to tell us what kind of school reforms are going to work in each one of the states. We talked about charters, and I'll talk about that a little later. I think the point with charters is that it can be a very vital part of a school reform strategy, as it probably, I think, is considered in your state, where the whole charter movement really originated. But there are a number of states around the country, notably Maryland, North Carolina, West Virginia, that have made incredible strides in their school reform efforts without including charter schools as part of the package. So the thought of having charter schools foisted upon those states where their reforms have been successful sort of rises to a level of absurdity. The overall selection criteria, one of which is a maintenance of effort for state education spending, there is a movement afoot at the federal level at the Department of Ed to make education funding a priority by each state, having to provide evidence that the education spending as a percentage of the state budget remains constant on a yearly basis or increases. We see maintenance of effort requirements as a condition of taking Title I money now, but they're relatively relaxed compared to this proposal, which would establish a structure for looking at your state budget and your state appropriations process every year to determine whether or not you were spending the same percentage of your general fund on education as you have been in past years, or increasing it. The race to the top legislation ensconced in the stimulus also requires that the governor submit the application for race to the top, that there would be a report including the status on those four reforms, the first four reforms I talked about, that there's a report on the achievement and graduation rates in the state, a description of how stimulus dollars have been used and will be used if you get some race to the top money,
and some additional requirements that are going to come out after the regulatory process is over in the guidance process that the department uses to explain their regulatory decision. The state's application has to be signed by the governor, the chief state school officer or commissioner, and the president of the state board of education if you have one. You've already brought up the issue of the legislator's role. The legislature's role is you inherit this. And we'll talk a little bit about this. Whatever commitments that are made, clearly this is a one-shot deal. The money's going to come and go rather quickly. And if any long-term commitments are made, that falls down to the state level to support and fund. They're talking about doing this in two phases. The first phase, the applications would be processed late this year, and it's looking later and later, Mr. Chairman, as you indicated. And in phase two, another round that you would be eligible for, even if you missed the first round or if you were denied the first round, you would be eligible for phase two, and the deadline for that will be sometime in late spring. There's some pretty superficial and obvious concerns over process. The paperwork burden for filling out one of these applications is estimated to be 642 staff hours for a state education agency. It raises the question of the capacity of small state SEAs versus large state SEAs to actually process all this information and put a package together that meets all the criteria that the department has laid out. Certainly, a state like Utah, where the state education agency is very, very small, would suffer in regard to having the resources to allocate towards putting this proposal together compared to a state with a relatively significant SEA organization.
But we probably fall more in that latter category, and then on top of that,
yeah.
Our department, our state was gifted a grant from the Gates Foundation to be able to pay for some of the vetting and logistical gathering and constructing a proposal and engaging the public. And I believe there were only a handful of states that were still chosen.
There's about 15 states that the Gates Foundation volunteered to assist. It's interesting because there are 15 states that the department said were going to be in the first round of funding, and there is certainly a lot of speculation as to whether those two lists overlap one another.
Mm-hmm.
There is a pretty strong Gates presence in the Department of Ed now, and there's a pretty strong presence, a formal presence of the Department of Ed and the Gates working together on a number of these issues. The question of will your use of stimulus funds to close budget gaps handicap your application? I mean, every state has used the stimulus funds to close holes in your budget. I can't think of one that hasn't. But there is some kickback from the Department of Ed in the form of a finding from the IG's office, the Inspector General's office, as to what they expect to do regarding states using funding for closing budget gaps. And one of their remedies for this within the department is to implement a process to track state support for elementary and secondary education, and to establish and implement a process to ensure that states have met MOE requirements and assurances prior to awarding additional stimulus funding. This is four states that they've found this, they issued this finding on, and it could make a lot of states very nervous because most states did have to use their stimulus money to save jobs and to close budget gaps.
Mr. Shreve, I'm going to push you along a little bit here.
Okay.
And because I want to make sure.
Raises the other question of who pays for phase three of the stimulus act, and the trick to this statement is there is no phase three. You get the money in phase one or phase two, or you don't get it at all. And the answer to that question is who pays for phase three. If there is a phase three, look in the mirror, look at your colleagues next to you, and you'll figure out who would have to pay for the commitments made by the response to the stimulus act. There are concerns over the philosophy of this program. I think I articulated those pretty well in the responses we saw from the governance groups. If you reward states for doing things right, which is what this is about, what happens to those states that are left behind? Do they get further behind, or is there some movement to bring them up as well? We have some issues about the department and the Gates Foundation both sort of picking losers and winners. More philosophical questions. Is this a bottom-up or top-down approach? And I think from what I read to you from our response, it's clearly a top-down approach that's being offered stuff. You take this deal and you meet these conditions in order to be eligible. It includes the common standards movement, which NCSL has a really really difficult problem with, because the common standards movement, while it's a good idea, offers a temptation to the feds to get involved, which they've already succumbed to, and made adopting these common standards a part of the condition for receiving Race to the Top money, and then setting aside additional money for $350 million to develop common assessments. And the common standards people will tell you the first step is common common standards, the next step is common assessments, the next step is common curriculum, and the final step is common teacher preparation programs. This is their public plan for moving the common standards forward. Obviously, the preemption of state laws is a precondition for eligibility. The way I look at that is that at some point, even though it's a carrot, it becomes a big, heavy carrot that you get beat over the head with, and it operates like a stick and not a carrot. And then finally, on the questions of philosophy, this is a quote by Diane Ravitch, who was Assistant Secretary under the first President Bush, that there, what is extraordinary about these regulations is they have no credible basis in research. They just happen to be the programs and approaches favored by the people in power. I think Professor Ravitch did that very well. And then finally, when you think in terms of what you're going to do to turn around the education reform efforts in your state, I think you have to think in terms of turning around an oil tanker where they plan and plot their moves days and weeks and months sometimes in advance because of the size of the endeavor and the resistance that that endeavor has to change. In summary, if I had to come up with a list, which I sort of took off the top of my head because this is really new ground for most of us, this is what I would recommend that you consider as legislative body. Emphasize the use of the Race to the Top money to support self-sustainable projects, not programs, but projects and systematic change. Remember, the legislature is going to inherit the commitments made by executive branch grant writers should they be approved. And that it's not likely that even if you do all the things that are required under Race to the Top, the four assurances, the four items that you have to touch base on, there's no guarantee and there's certainly no research to support the idea that you're going to be dealing with things like closing the achievement gap or addressing the wider issue of disadvantaged learners. We're talking about things in the four assurances and the data and the teacher system that really are really long-term before you see a payback in their ability to close achievement gaps and deal with disadvantaged workers. If you're concerned about issues like limited English proficiency students, I suggest you see the Council of Great City Schools report that was issued this month, identifying St. Paul and three other cities as sort of exemplary LEP programs. And their emphasis in that study shows that these programs are emphasizing advocacy, leadership, collaboration, use of data, and strong financial support. So not programs, not people, not more contact, but more of a streamlining and a focus of existing resources. I think one of the other things the legislature needs to do is to convey some sense of the legislature, and we've seen this happen in a couple of states, some sense of the legislature to the SEA, to make sure the SEA grant writers understand what your guidelines would be if you had a role in this, and what those should be for self-sustaining projects. I think the legislature needs to convey the concerns that Race to the Top is fixed to federal policymakers, and I mean that in exactly the way I said it. There is some pretty strong feeling in Washington that the list of the first states that are going to be endowed with the Race to the Top money has already been determined. It reminds me of the World Wrestling Federation. If you don't think that they have a good idea who's going to win,
If you think of how Hulk Hogan won all those matches that he won on TV, I got something I can sell you in Washington as well.
I just thought he was an extraordinary athlete. Representative Detmer would agree with that. He's a wrestler as well.
And then finally, convey the sense that you need to think ahead. Something like common standards on the face of it sounds really good, but the feds are one step ahead of you in pushing to take control of the standards movement and the assessment movement. And if we don't convey the way we feel about those issues to the federal government, this seems to be a very activist administration and an activist Department of Education. I think they're going to push and push and push and expand their role until somebody pushes back. And then finally, just to close, I think one of the things you need to do is exercise oversight as you're doing right now, and emphasizing the fact that in the minds of most people in the states and outside of Washington, the state is not determined by the State Education Agency or the State Department of Transportation. It's better defined by the legislative and executive branch of the state, and not just one branch over the other. So good luck, and if we have time, I'm more than happy to take some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shreve. We are behind in our schedule, so I'm going to hold off on questions so that we can push forward with the amendments, rather with the agenda. I trust you'll be able to stay through the end of the hearing, and hopefully we'll come back and have some questions for you. So we're going to move forward. At this point, Assistant Commissioner Karen Lindsay. And while she comes up, I just want to share with the audience that what we did in preparation for this hearing, partly because the proposal itself is still being developed. We don't have a proposal in front of us, although if the department has one and wants to lay it out, we'll certainly love to see it. But my understanding is it's still being developed, and so what what the chairs did is we came up with what we thought were some initial critical questions, and those are listed on the agenda before you. For those of you in the audience, I think we do have extra copies of the agenda if you don't have it up at the front table. And so what we've asked the department is to frame their presentation around answering those questions, and I suspect the goals that those will generate further questions from members around the table. So with that, I'm going to call on you, Commissioner Lindsay. Welcome, good to see you. And I understand you were on a plane earlier today, somewhere over Minnesota.
I was on the Iron Range.
Up in the Iron Range, good place to be.
It was a good place to be. They always put me in a good mood up there. So it's good to be back safely. It was not a good day to be flying on in a prop plane. So thanks for having us today. As was requested, we do not have a PowerPoint presentation. We simply are going to be talking off of the questions that were delivered to us from the committee. The first question was about what Minnesota's process is for developing its Race to the Top application. And as you heard, it is part of the ARRA money through the U.S. Department of Education under the direction of Secretary Arne Duncan. The Minnesota Department of Education process for developing this consists of first collaborating with key stakeholders to review Minnesota initiatives that meet those Race to the Top grant criteria and then highlight some of the Minnesota education innovation reforms. That's really the process the step we are still in, because it takes a while to get around the state and make sure that we are taking input from multiple stakeholders. And a number of you have been involved in that, and I know we saw some of you on the road this week when we were out in your various regions. Secondly, development of a high level.
As I said earlier, I want to make sure that we're engaging in a discussion, but can you tell us a little bit more in terms of the process, the role of the Gates Foundation, why Minnesota, and the role of the McKenzie Group in regards to the process?
Sure. I think that you are referring to, Chair Mariani, the fact that we do have consultants who are assisting the state in soliciting this input from around the state. I think it is, we are fortunate as a state to have this additional assistance to defray some of the hours that you saw was presented earlier that the SEA would otherwise have to devote to this to have a competitive proposal. But secondly, it's nice to kind of have an independent voice out there that's soliciting these comments and helping to bring the state together around this. And we, as a state, were selected by the Gates Foundation early on in the Race to the Top process as one of the states that's highly competitive based on a lot of the initiatives that we've already engaged in over the last, actually, 10 to 20 years. That we've shown ourselves going in, as a state, going in a very good direction. As a result, then they, along with 15 other states, they selected Minnesota to receive grant dollars to be spent on choosing an external consultant. So we were given seven choices, and from those seven choices, we evaluated the prospectuses that were given to us and submitted a few names to Gates, and then they matched up the various 15 states with their top one, two, or three choice based on how many, because the consultant can only handle so many.
I'm somewhat familiar with the decision group, but I want to send everyone around the team and maybe just talk quickly who they are. What do they do?
The McKinsey Group is they're really a group of consultants that have been, they are asked to consult on a number of different projects, including a number of education projects. Some of the education projects that they have been hired to consult on in this state include some assistance with the Minneapolis School District on their reform and redesign plans this past year, as well as the Itasca project. They've also been hired by that group in the past to consult for them.
I think we have a question from Representative Brainerd. And let me just quickly, because we've had a several members that have joined us, Representative Mack, welcome. Representative Brainerd, also welcome. I believe Representative Slocum and Representative Norton. I'm sorry I'm not doing that a full name and affiliation, but I do want to keep us moving with the testimony. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, this question is related to the hearings this week, and I don't want to put you in a defensive posture in relation to those hearings, because I know they were conducted intensely in a variety of locations, and you probably even haven't gotten feedback on all of them at this point. But I wasn't able to attend the hearing in my area, but I asked for some input and heard from, regionally from some administrators, and two concerns that I heard expressed. One was questions about whether the message is consistent or has been consistent across the state, what people were hearing in the different locations across the state, questioning whether that was consistent. And I'm thinking that's coming because superintendents are talking to each other and thinking they heard different things. So that's one point. And then the second was some concerns about whether there was adequate time for true stakeholder input in these hearings. Some of the hearings may be diverged into other concerns, and a lot of stakeholders felt they really didn't have a chance to have adequate input. And because of the tight timeline and the application, I'm hearing concern about whether they ever will have time for adequate input. And so those are just two things I think it's important that we have some public discussion about.
Thank you for the feedback. We have been collecting feedback and trying to adjust accordingly all week. As you've mentioned, it's a fast timeline, and we are trying to get to as many areas as possible and as quickly as possible so that we don't feel like we're leaving anybody out. But we will take that feedback to heart and know that we're only in step one. There are four other steps, and I think we plan to have feedback loops in all of those steps, and so we'll keep that in mind as we go forward. So, and I do want to mention, too, that the Bush Foundation and Minneapolis Foundation locally actually augmented the Gates Foundation grant for the consulting so that we also had some local support for our competitiveness for this grant. The second step will be developing a high-level implementation plan, selecting some policies for inclusion in the Race to the Top application. There's already emerging consensus that some of you saw on the PowerPoint slides that came out of the Race to the Top stakeholder groups at the beginning. And I know some folks have wished that we could hand those out, but I will say there's quite a fervor out there by other states to get their hands on other states. Slides like that, and we're trying hard to stay competitive. And a lot of folks are looking at Minnesota as one of those states that has great ideas. Third, development of a rollout trajectory will come and budget with budget implications. Then fourth, we'll collect stakeholder letters of support. And I imagine at those times we'll have a lot of more public meetings, and then fifth, we'll be working with local school districts to gain some more commitment to the Race to Top application if they're interested. So that's the five stages that we're going through. We're still in stage one, and we are still operating off of a proposed set of criteria for this. The official guidance is still not before us, but we figured if we get started right now, then it gives us more time to engage as a public in a public discussion. The second question we were asked about is where Minnesota stands on a number of these reform conditions and what, if any, legislative proposals do we anticipate in needing to meet the reform conditions. I will point out there are a number of states who have either gone into special session or are in session trying to pass legislation to meet reform conditions. One of the reasons I think Minnesota was identified as highly competitive by some entities is that we really don't have a lot of legislative obstacles to being able to engage in these reform conditions. We don't have caps on charters. We don't have any legislation getting in the way of certain data elements. And those are mostly the things that legislatures in other states have had to convene in order to make themselves eligible for Race to the Top applications. With respect to great teachers and leaders, we already engage in this job embedded professional development. We already have a program that evaluates and compensates teachers based on performance, and it's being adopted by a number of school districts. And the linkage of student achievement with teachers and their prep programs is currently under development through our longitudinal data system. And we are working with the higher education entities on that. In standards and assessments, we have the high standards. We are being tapped, and we feel honored by this, to consult and advise in the development of the Common Core state standards. And this is a joint effort by the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers. It really comes about as a result of the America Diploma Project and how successful that was. That was a voluntary state effort. States volunteered to be part of that. Initially, there were a handful. And by the time about 4 years had gone by, most states had engaged in the America Diploma Project process. And what they found, as he found as a result of that, is that most states ended up with very similar standards. And so this is meant to really solidify and articulate what those common core standards are, high standards for all kids across the nation. So Minnesota is in a good position there. We are in a good position with data systems. We've been building the 10 elements that need to be there according to the data quality campaign, and we only have two left, and they are currently under development. In turning around struggling schools, one of the options that the Obama administration really feels is important for being able to turn around struggling schools is that option to change governance structures, whether it be in the way of self-governed schools or the chartering governance structure. The Obama administration wanted to make sure that states didn't have caps on those, and we do not. So, in fact, we have a couple different laws that make it possible for schools to self-govern.
or partly a reference to your legislation this past year. You must have had just incredible foresight with federal resources.
It gives us a little boost up, so thank you for that legislation. And additionally, we do get some competitive points for STEM. And so Minnesota is being tapped for our leadership in the STEM areas, and it's leadership that's really been around and sustained over the last 6 years. That, I think, is going to carry us a long ways in the application as well.
So I'm wondering, I've seen you're coming to the end of at least the written answers to question two, but part of question two was also an attempt to try to, and I know the proposal is not put together yet, but an attempt for this body, for the legislature, to have an understanding of what, if any, legislative action would be called for as a result of a proposal that follows any of these, builds upon any of these areas. Obviously, we're in session in February, and you know, this is that time of year. I don't know about you all, but this is that time of year when I start thinking about February session is next week. And trying to prepare ourselves for what will be a tough session, but also a very short session. We're going to have to move very smartly and very quickly around policy. So at this point, what can the department tell us in terms of what it's anticipating, if anything, relative to statutory changes? And if not, does the department anticipate using rulemaking in any sort of rulemaking in order to further fit Minnesota's framework relative to the emerging proposal?
Probably faster to come to legislature than to go through rulemaking. I don't know of any rulemaking that's anticipated at this point, except around the standards. We are currently working on getting the science standards through rulemaking per the statutory process that's been outlined for us. But the science standards are not part of the Common Core, so those will not be affected. Could there be rulemaking required for adoption of the Common Core? That is possible, but it is very difficult for us to determine at this point if that is the case, because we have not seen the K-12 draft. We've not seen a single draft of the K-12 Common Core State Standards. All we have seen at this point is the College and Career Readiness Guidelines, Principles. They've changed the word a few times. At first, we thought they were the graduation standards, but really they're just kind of the College and Career Ready vision. Based on that document, we don't believe there will be any significant change in the rigor level of the standards, but how it gets scoped and sequenced and scaffolded, K-12, could be something that we need to revisit. But we do have a week-by-week feedback opportunities to give to the development of these. We are one of three states that has this opportunity because they want and really have respected the feedback they've already received from Minnesota teachers, curriculum directors, and other higher education faculty who've been providing feedback for the Common Core. The other elements are reform conditions. They're at this time, because it is so premature in the planning process and we don't know what the plan is, we don't know if the plans that are being proposed and are going to be decided upon are going to trigger the need for some legislation. But clearly, once those plans are determined, we're going to have, if they do trigger a need for some legislation, we'll have to come straight to you right away. The LEAs and how they be selected. We expect all Minnesota school districts and charter schools are eligible to participate, and but they will elect to do so by signing a memorandum of understanding for the proposal once they've had a chance to review it and decide if that's something that they want to be part of. In addition, I'll just say that there will be things that, should we get the grant money for some of the proposed items, such as building educator portals, such as curriculum frameworks, such as certain online resources, all states will always be eligible for receiving those, whether they sign on to the LEA side of this proposal or not.
Now, my understanding, Commissioner, is that, and you get to this a little bit later in the memo, that there's a 50-50 split in terms of monies that will go directly towards schools, as opposed to monies that will be controlled primarily by the FDA. And actually, I believe the language in the guidelines is at least 50 to go to schools. So I guess what I'm trying to sort through is that an automatic at least 50 that flows to those Title I schools, or do all schools need to actively step forward and sign a memorandum of agreement in order to be eligible for either one of those streams of participation in those two streams of investment?
The wording of the guidelines at that point construe that it has to flow to the LEAs who have signed on or committed to the state application, so it will not be an automatic flow. So if only 10, well, I think we'll need more than 10 to show that the state's willing and ready and able. And some of that's subjective as to how many LEAs we'll need to sign on for us to really show that our proposal and our state's serious about this. But it'll be divided, that 50%, among those states, or I mean those LEAs who sign on.
I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm wondering about what the LEAs who do sign on, what their level of agreement needs to be with the specific details of the application. Mm-hmm. For instance, are you only going to accept LEAs who are currently involved in QComp or who are planning on applying for QComp?
Commissioner.
That's a very good question. That's one of those I heard from superintendents today. In fact, one came into the room and said, if that's all you need is to know if I'm in QComp or not, I might as well get my cookie and pop and walk out of here. We really have not made that determination yet that's the condition for being in this. That has not been a condition that's been determined.
Commissioner, hold on a second. Representative Norton?
Kind of following up, Mr. Chair, in the line of Kathy Brannert's comments and questions, and you were in Rochester, and I know one of the things that was brought up there by many of the district administrators was the concern with the short timeline, with not exactly knowing what the application is going to look like, and then the short timeline where they have to make that decision, many of them will not have the opportunity to even get to their staff to see if the staff are even interested in doing this. And in fact, one of them said there's only one meeting between now and the first of the year with their staff, and it may or may not fall in line with when the application's due. And so I think there was some concern and frustration, not only that there's not enough time to determine whether it's right for their district, but between now and when the application is due, and they have to say they're going to commit to it. And then the question was raised, what if they do sign up, and then the application is approved, we get the money, they look at it and say, oh, this really isn't anything we want to do, then is there an opportunity to get out? And I just thought I would raise that publicly, and then if you want to address what you told the group.
Thank you. I concur with your concern about the speedy timeline for regions to be able to try to make sure that they're signing on with that consensus. They do have to have labor and management sign the letter, and that's a requirement of the current guidelines. I don't know the exact answer because we haven't seen the guidelines. I think that what we want to know, we want to go forward with a proposal that shows we have enough state commitment that they know we're really serious about this, ready and willing. It's subjective, though, and we're just guessing at what that's going to be. So we hope that when districts sign on, they're serious and we don't have a lot of bloodletting afterwards. But we're on the timeline that the Obama administration puts us on.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, Commissioner, whether the NDA is going to include a request for funding. It's kind of follow-up on Chairman Mariani's comments about the site-based or autonomous school law that was passed and signed by the governor this year as a way of giving some funding for planning, for starting up, for the turnaround of struggling schools, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Has that become part of the discussion mm-hmm. in this application process?
The self-governed schools legislation has become a strong component of what we have in place, and something that has been recommended is something to capitalize and leverage. So that any additional input you want to give us about how to leverage that statute would be very helpful, because it's a nice alternative to some of the other recommendations under that particular assurance around struggling schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson, that was one of my concerns about the hearings this week. When I was in the stakeholders group, my group was pushing very strongly for that to be an option, and we thought that was a bigger trump card than charter schools just being the panacea for all ills with other schools, and that would actually be something that Minnesota could get ahead of the other states, because creativity is apparently to be rewarded. And yet, when we got to the emergent issues, while it was given some lip service, it didn't appear in the writing of the application. So I think you and anyone who supports it, and I will say it again, needs to talk to the Department of Education and try to get it on paper. Because saying it's a good alternative, but all we see on paper is charter schools, isn't good enough.
Thanks, Ms. Chair. And to this point, it strikes me that from what I understand of the charter model that both the Secretary of Education and the President are most familiar and supportive with, it's much more similar to our self-governed schools model mm-hmm. than it is to our charter model. And my understanding is also that the Chicago charter model is more successful in terms of student achievement than our charter model is. So I think I'm reinforcing Chair Greiling's point that if we're really trying to grab the attention of the folks who are making the decisions in D.C., that doing things that looks like, walks like, and quacks like what they're used to, it makes more sense than doing something that has the name but doesn't have the substance.
Thank you. You're getting some good advice that hopefully you and your staff are adding to the pool of
And I just want to point out the slides you probably saw this week were coming out, emerging consensus from some of the stakeholder groups, and I think I've seen it on other documents that the agency is starting to put together about background on what we have. So it could be that it just isn't as well known to some of the stakeholders who were in the room who brought it up, and so McKinsey didn't think to put it there because they don't know about it. But we'll take that feedback back. It's great.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to do what chairs get to do, which is, you can kind of just move the agenda around. I'm going to jump you over to the early childhood education issue. One-third of the committees present here are the early childhood education finance, and one of the concerns that many people in that community have is the sense that that perhaps the race to the top framework from the federal government may be missing the boat on early childhood. And so if you can share with us what the department's current thinking is relative to its proposal mm-hmm. on this issue, and what you're hearing as you're engaging with folks, because I suspect you're hearing from others as well on the early childhood issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an opportunity in this proposal for us to showcase our P20 initiative. They call it an invitational condition or priority. Unfortunately, with invitational, it doesn't come with extra points, but I'm sure it comes with some brownie points. And being educators ourselves, I'm sure we all know a little bit about brownie points. But to that extent, our K-12 proposal in Minnesota, we're hoping to really showcase the fact that we have aligned K-12 kindergarten readiness programs, assessments, data, because they're part of a P20 longitudinal data system that's being proposed, and we hope to highlight some of the early childhood indicators of progress, which are our standards for early childhood that are aligned to our K-12 standards, and also some of the professional development that is done for early childhood. So we do believe on the P side of the P20, as well as on the 18 to 20 side, well, I guess it'd be 13 to 20, we have some things to showcase there as the fact that this is a comprehensive proposal.
Commissioner, showcase, I want to make sure I'm understanding that word correctly. Is that a matter of just sort of pointing to what our strengths are as a state relative to the overall proposal, or are there concrete thoughts emerging about investing dollars that can enhance our work in early childhood in the state?
Certainly, some of the emerging consensus is indicating that some focus on those early years could really contribute to closing the achievement gap, and so they're certainly part of the discussion, just like all the emerging consensus has been. There is no specific plan yet at this point, though no decisions have been made.
And then, Commissioner, let me just push a little bit, just kind of in general. So you mentioned the P20 commission, and I think Professor Swales, you had the bill to actually formalize that entity as a legal entity in state statute, but we certainly have had a history of working in similar group for a number of years. But it seems to me, and this will probably be more the subject of a later hearing, but it seems to me that one of the things that that both the executive branch and the legislative branch should be doing relative to this opportunity is to review, what our current, and so this is going to jump you down to number seven, but is to review what our current decisions have been relative to being able to provide a sustained level of investment and policy focus in key areas that are serving as touch points for this proposal. And so, for instance, in the last, I believe, I'm correct when I say this, in the last K-12 bill, we funded certain efforts like the Power of You, which speaks to kind of this extension of opportunity beyond 12th grade into the first 2 years of post-secondary as sort of a manifestation of our understanding of a very integrated, E through 16 system. That particular investment was line item vetoed by the governor. It would seem to me that if you're a federal reviewer, you might want to ask questions about what the state's commitment is and relative to sort of the continuity. That's just one example. I guess the broader question is that will there be a set of sort of reviews on the part of the department based on this proposal on our current reform efforts in the state, and whether or not we need to revisit, some of those, maybe return some investments in areas where we felt we needed to cut those out or continue to push policy forward. And I know this is awkward because we're kind of jumping ahead of what, not having a proposal here, to serve, but what I'm sort of getting at really is sort of, what is the attitude, if you will? What is the sort of place that the department and the executive branch is putting itself in terms of how it's going to handle a consistent message of education reform and investment in reform in our state?
Well, in spirit of race to the top, and you're starting to identify some of the things that Minnesota has done really that has shown why we're competitive and the things that we've done to really try to close the achievement gap. We do have to do a review in this particular proposal. It's part of the background is reviewing things that have been done and maybe aren't being done anymore. And some of the input that we've received is to renew certain efforts that we thought were effective. So that's more input and feedback we need to put as part of the emerging consensus. And that review will probably that needs to be in the application. The application will need to receive feedback from the public. So if it's not in there, there can be things that you recommend need to be added.
Yeah, I think there will be. And again, I think the desire of everyone around the room is to make sure we do have sort of the best proposal to get needed resources into the state. And I think that does involve a process of us reviewing both executive and legislative branches, based on, whatever levels of investment we've made to reform and whatever policy areas that we've either pushed aside or pushed forward to either reaffirm or to bring back, to the top of our efforts here. If I were a federal reviewer, I'd be asking lots of questions about the states, not only about the proposal, but I'd be looking at immediate past practices to see if the proposal is matching the behavior of the state relative to those kind of investments and those policy initiatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, this sort of piggybacks on what the Chair has been talking about a broader umbrella in terms of our policy positions and the research we've used as a state to ground the kind of educational approaches we've taken up to now. And I guess this also reflects back to David Shreve's issue about what the research base is or isn't for the four areas. And I would ask, I guess the broad question is, how is it that research will inform our application process? Related to that is the question about the role of early childhood, because, I know in the executive summary that we've received, and that's all I haven't looked at the details, but you talked about early childhood being an invitational priority. Nevertheless, I would think an argument can be made very strongly from a policy point of view that the research says otherwise, that it ought to be more than that. And, I guess I'm thinking along the lines that the Chair is directing, might we not think as a state of not only trying to showcase what it is we're doing that reflects the four areas that the federal government is looking to see about our current practice and our long-range vision, but might we not also try in our application to raise their consciousness and redirect their thinking about where the research should be directing us. And one of those is early childhood as a foundational piece of reform and closing the achievement gap. So am I making sense where I'm going? I'm talking about the role of research and then whether we should be positioning some policy issues a little differently than the application seems to be positioning them.
Well, I do think that what I want to say about the early childhood piece is that I don't think you're wrong in us possibly taking a strong narrative stance in our proposal about presenting early childhood, but we do need to present it in balance with the rest of the initiatives because it's a proposal for grant funds. And we can use it to try to talk to the Obama administration about where their priorities are, but it needs to be, if we're going for grant funding, we probably want to make sure that there's enough left in the grant or in the proposal for them to really want to then reward us for our grant. So I hear that, and I think probably, not sure I can really speak for the Obama administration, but I know that he has a number of other pieces of legislation that are going through the Congress to provide a substantial amount of similar kinds of funding for early childhood. And so we wouldn't want to run the risk of trying to make this all about early childhood and have them thinking, yeah, but that's for the Early Learning Challenge grants, which are coming down the road later. So I hear you, but I think we'll want to make sure that this is it's put in perspective for this particular set of guidelines that we've been issued by Secretary Duncan's office.
And many of us do write grants, but we do understand that when the guidelines are out, you know, you address yourself to the guidelines. So we do appreciate the difficulty of being able to send a holistic message to a grantor at the same time that you want to make sure you're addressing the you know, what the grantor has already prioritized is what the issues are. So
yeah.
I think what Representative Bider is raising is sort of a healthy tension of being able to use that opportunity having a strong proposal at the same time that you're really pushing the envelope. And on that score, let me just push you a little bit more. And I know we have several members from communities of color in the state present, many of whom I do work with. One of the issues, it seems to me, for our state, now we're not unique in this regard. There are what we call the achievement gaps that exist everywhere across the nation. However, there are some, depending on how you measure and indicate, and measure the or look at the indicators, the state of Minnesota, has some pretty large achievement gaps. Tell us how that reality is factoring into the preparation of this grant, and what is it that you and your the McKinsey Group is doing in terms of being able to root, if you are, ground and root this proposal within the realities of those communities and your engagement with those communities in the preparation of the proposal.
We have convened a number of stakeholders in the initial meetings that we hoped would convene a wide array of representatives from across the state who would help ground this proposal and emerging consensus in some strategies that could really help turn around achievement, provide opportunities where maybe gaps are there for opportunity. And so I think the public input on that and emerging consensus so far has been very valuable in making sure that when we're presenting and putting together and coalescing these ideas, that is a key focus, if not a hallmark focus, of this particular opportunity. I do think that Race to the Top gives us a special opportunity to spend, yes, albeit one-time funds. In that, I agree with the previous presenter that we really need to make sure we remember these are one-time funds. That's what was intended by these, and I think they're meant to retool some of our systemic approaches to students so that we make our systemic approaches more opportunistic for all kids, while keeping the same high rigor. And you do mention the gap in Minnesota. Some of the, we see the gap. It looks very wide. However, one of the, I think, great things about the gap in Minnesota is our students in some of these areas, socioeconomically challenged categories, actually are outperforming other students in those same categories in other states. So what it's showing us is that we know how to bring achievement up for all kids. So we know there are some things going on across the state. If we could just accelerate them and ramp them up, that we would have some opportunities and we could retool some things with this one-time money to really focus in on those areas where some great things are happening for all students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last week, Commissioner Klinzing and Representative Norton and McFarland and I all had the opportunity with many other stakeholders to attend the discussion of the TIMSS test at the Science Museum. Mm-hmm. And I think, Dr. Schmidt, William Schmidt from the University of Michigan was there, who did the explication of the data that is related to the TIMSS test. And I think that based on the success of Minnesota from when the students were tested for that, was it 1995, the first one, and then 2007, and the extraordinary improvement of our students, and the data that shows that by the kind of work that has been done on streamlining the standards, digging down more deeply in core concepts, building that at least in the math standards, and if we can replicate that across the other disciplines, I think that we are in a very good position, and I think we do have the data that's showing from the very earliest grades that we are making tremendous progress in the state. So I guess I would just like to really affirm the work that the department is doing. There's a lot of really innovative things that we learned about in that particular evening's discussion. And I guess, you know, Commissioner Quinzing, if there are any of the things that we talked about last week that you feel would be relevant to this, because there was a presentation of really wonderful things that Minnesota is doing, and I think it would help this group of all of us could have been a part of that discussion. I thought it was excellent.
Well, you do point out the Transit International Math and Science Study. One of the things that Minnesota is being noted for is that between 95 and 2007, we saw significant gains, 3 to 4 times the standard deviation in math scores for our fourth graders across all socioeconomic levels. So we still have a gap, and we want to bring all kids up to the same high level of performance, but so all kids are outperforming the nation and in many cases all kids in the world in those similar socioeconomic areas. That said, I think there are always extra things that need to be done to help kids who continue to struggle more than other kids. And this particular one-time funding does give us some opportunity to enhance our data systems forever. I mean, it's the one-time investment that can be made so teachers can really drill down. And it's also an opportunity for teachers to get some one-time experience with some specific, possibly culturally responsive strategies for dealing with kids who are particularly struggling. But we do have a lot of data, both in our ACT data. That's another area where we're seeing strong gains for some students who typically are not as well performing in other states, as well as some of our AP and IB data starting to show huge growth in achievement and participation for students typically who were not tracked into those kinds of courses.
I do want to continue with questions, and we do have some witnesses, but I do want to say I know that a number of our members live in exurban parts of the Twin Cities and maybe even the rural communities outside. And so I just want to say, you know, to those fellow members that if it's getting late, some of you have to teach in the morning, please don't feel unabashed about getting up and leaving. And please understand that if that happens, it's not because they're not interested in the hearing, but we do have members who do have to travel a distance yet this evening. Except for Representative Garofalo, he's stuck here. So, Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the direction of the conversation at this time. It's reminding me a bit of when I was teaching, and before a test, I'd always give out a study guide. And for most of the kids, it allowed them to focus their review. But there was always the kid that if on the study guide I asked, okay, what's the difference between Paris and Warsaw? They'd come in with the answer. But then if on the test, instead of asking that question, I asked what was the difference between the distance between Rome and Berlin, they couldn't figure that out. Because they'd missed that what I wanted them to do was not memorize the distance between Paris and Warsaw. I don't know what it is, and I don't really care. But I wanted them to learn the process of doing the measurement. And I'm hearing some mixed signals from the department tonight, and I'm afraid that we're missing the target and maybe dismissing the target. Yes, this is about filling out an application. But I fear the department is the kid coming in with the measure between Paris and Berlin, or Paris and Warsaw, who hasn't figured out how to do the measurement. So
the point of Race to the Top is to, the opportunity in Race to the Top is for us to revisit the issue of the achievement gap in Minnesota. As the chair has indicated, review some of the decisions that have been made, under, particularly under this administration, that have hampered closing the achievement gap, undermining extended time revenue, the veto of the power of you, capping ELL at 5 years funding for students who are learning English language, things like that, and embrace this opportunity to review those decisions and to look forward, not to fill out an application, but to create the opportunity for students across the state. And I'm getting concerned that we're missing or dismissing the target. Thank you.
Let me close out this section here just with this final, and I know we didn't have you go through all the questions, but I think we kind of got through them anyway in pieces by jumping around. But question seven does have to do with this issue of long-term investment and what, if anything, does the proposal suggest to the state about ongoing investments in reform and innovation. And I take it from the answer here that basically the executive branch will be helping, will be identifying what that will be in the process of this grant. And let me just say that as the chair of the policy committee, I'm not the finance chair, but chair of the policy committee, that that would be a very helpful exercise for me and for members of my committee, that we have a good sense from the executive branch, what their best thoughts and priorities are in terms of where we need to continue to make investments in reform areas in the state of Minnesota. And so I do look forward to that coming forward, and with hope that once the proposal is finished and submitted, that we can return to a public hearing to have a discussion, partly based on being able to have a real thorough exploration of what those investments should be. And obviously we'll fight over what level they should be, but it's really important that at the end, it seems to me that we're not forgetting that it does take investment sometimes to be able to do the kind of reform that we want to do. Commissioner, I want to thank you for your presentation today. We are going to go a little bit more, members. Feel free. I know some of you do need to drive long distances. And if you have to do that, feel free to go. But I do want to hear from the folks that are at least scheduled on the testimony list. And so at this point, I would ask the Association of Superintendents, School Board Association, and Ed Minnesota to come up and match. And there should be enough room at the table for all three groups to offer their testimony. I know people will be moving throughout the room, and so if we can keep that down, the noise to a minimum, so we can make sure we get this testimony, I greatly appreciate it. So welcome. Identify yourself for the record. And
good evening.
Your thoughts with us.
I'm Charlie Kite, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And my first observation, Chairman Mariani and Chairman Greiling, is either it is really, really hot in this room, or I'm coming down with some dreaded communicable disease. And I hope it's the former. As I make my few quick comments tonight, I want to say up front that I'm trying hard to be positive, but some of the things I'm going to say are not going to be so positive, okay? We have four observations, and we've been pulling information in from all over the state from our members in the last few days. In fact, as I was sitting here, two more long emails from two superintendents came in to me. But my first observation is this. Race to the Top is very typical of many federal grant proposals. It's just bigger. And what I would say about them is they are very structured in their requirements, And typically we, be it a school district or the state, spends a lot more time trying to hit their requirements than actually trying to actually bring some innovation to the solution or to the problem that's out there. That's the first observation. And I'm getting this not only from my own feelings, but also from what we're getting from our folks that are emailing back to us. Second observation is, and this is my own based on how I've been hearing the response from our members, there is deep, deep, and widespread skepticism of getting quote-unquote help from the federal government. Our folks that get money for IDEA, and we all understand how important it is to help the kids with special needs, but the regulations on it are just overwhelming. The NCLB has been an overwhelming difficulty for us for the last 8 years. So there's this deep frustration. Frankly, Commissioner Clinsey, I'm glad I wasn't up on the range today. It's not easy going out amongst the folks that I represent and trying to sell this idea because there is this, before you walk in the room, they're pretty sure they don't like it. And so it's not easy work. I'll also give you the rural perspective. I am meeting with all of the metro superintendents next Wednesday, and while I've gotten some individual feedback, I'll get more information next Wednesday. But from the rural perspective, they are feeling that in this particular grant proposal, most of the dollars are going to end up going to the urban core anyway. They have deep suspicion and long-term suspicions that that money sometimes isn't used all that effectively, and they therefore don't see this as being that helpful to them over the long run. And I actually tried to argue against that with them, but that's a deep feeling that they have. The third observation is that I'll just talk a little bit about the input process, the process of asking us for our opinion. There have been a couple of good stakeholder brainstorming meetings, and we've had four superintendents at those meetings. A little bit of a concern that they come back with is that amongst the group and in response to the grant, there isn't enough innovation to really make things change, to be a ball game changer. You know, if you're talking about $250 million, you'd like to change the ball game somehow. And they're afraid that that's not there. And that is not a criticism of the Department of Education. Don't get me wrong. It's kind of a criticism of the box that we're all kind of put in. On the regional meetings, the reaction I'm getting is all over the board. In some cases, I'm hearing from people saying, the folks that are out there meeting with us are really listening and they're getting input from us and they're trying to understand our concerns. In other cases, they're saying to me the input is very limited and this is just a pro forma game. There's a number of our members that feel that the cake has already been baked and they actually believe the grant is written and all this is just kind of a charade. I actually try to say to them, I don't think that's true, but that's some of the feeling that's out there. And as I said earlier, we have about 60 people that are providing us feedback, and specifically we asked them three questions. We said, number one, if Minnesota gets this grant, will the money actually help, A, Minnesota education statewide, and B, will it help individual school districts? That's one question that we're asking, and we're starting to get that feedback now. The second question is there enough innovation in innovation possibilities in this grant to justify the incursion of the federal bureaucracy that we'll take on as a result of trying to get the money? And C, are the people who are going out and looking for input generally listening to the folks out in the field or not? So I could tell you in about a week from now more completely what that feedback looks like, but right now it's coming in all over the board on all those questions, so it's a little difficult. I'll conclude by saying that NASA's big question is this. Will a fairly large, a large financial infusion over a short period of time actually be able to have a major impact on how well we educate the children of the state? Many of the requirements seem to cry for long-term investment, but in fact are a fairly short-term set of funding. Now, that said, NASA, our association, has not made a decision on where we're going to be on this. We are trying to be positive. We're trying to be cooperative. We understand if this kind of money comes to Minnesota and you can match it with a number of ideas that would actually make a difference, it could really be significant. But we're trying to sort that out right now. So that's our bit of testimony for tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I'm going to be very brief tonight, members, because I know the hour is late. Our members have worked actively back in even August working with the commissioner and talking about parameters for our state application. We've participated throughout the process. What you're seeing here is really a dual process happening not only in our state with our application, but as NCSL mentioned, at the federal rule and regulations level. And let me point out, what we don't know at the federal level is the program priorities, the definitions, and the selection criteria. And those are three biggies that we need to have our hands around. And so until we have that data from the federal government, it's hard for our members to really look at what some of these things could mean. We've always been concerned about the turnaround models that are used. It talks about a change in governance. Well, if you think about it, the definition of governance really matters. Are we talking a school board? Are we talking a superintendent? Are we talking a principal? Are we talking 50% of our teachers? What exactly do you mean by that? So we are waiting for those regulations to come out. We, as MASA, is also just waiting to see what our final application looks like, and we will go back to our members with that coming forward. But in brief, I want to have you consider that it does look like more one-time funding. And at least in Minnesota, we've hit so many funding cliffs through the year. I would hate to make one that's unsustainable. So being very careful how we use these dollars is important to us. I appreciate the opportunity.
Very good advice. Thank you. Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kate Jackson. I'm representing Education Minnesota here tonight. I'd like to point out that we have been asked here tonight to testify about the application process that is being used to develop this application. Before I do that, I'd like to take a moment and to clarify that Education Minnesota has not taken a formal position at this point on the application itself. We have not finished our research, but that will be coming. Education Minnesota is one of the stakeholders that has been participating in the stakeholder meetings. In addition, we have informed our members of the regional meetings that took place this week. And we encourage them to attend, although many of the meetings were held during the day and our teachers were unavailable. We have also worked with the Department of Education to set up a focus group of teachers that will be meeting tomorrow at Education Minnesota. Half of this group of teachers was selected by Education Minnesota. The other half was selected by the department. They will be meeting. They will be going through a process facilitated by the McKinsey Group. We understand the tight deadline the state is facing, and we appreciate the department's efforts to involve us and our members. Nevertheless, there are aspects of this application process that are raising questions and is causing us some concern. For example, we find it very difficult to get a hold of the copies of the presentations and the various documents used at the meetings we've been involved in as a stakeholder. We're also concerned about the ground rules that we were given in the stakeholder meetings. We were told not to focus on obstacles, or whether the race to the top criteria are the right criteria for Minnesota students. Even though the goal of the meeting was to gather a broad and diverse range of ideas, this raises questions about how willing the state will be to accept contrary ideas and critical feedback. During the meetings, the stakeholders were broken into several small groups for discussion. Their comments were compiled and reported out by the facilitators at a later meeting. In some cases, stakeholders representing us felt that what was reported out did not accurately reflect what was said in the group we participated in. Questions have been raised about whether the facilitators were reporting only the comments that seemed to fit a predetermined goal. We are concerned that at the regional meetings, the facilitators state, and we've heard it again this evening, there is an emerging consensus among the stakeholder groups. This implies to Education Minnesota that all parties will be in agreement with the concepts in the grant application. Since Education Minnesota, as one of the stakeholders, has expressed serious concerns, we are unaware of an emerging consensus. As I mentioned earlier, it's a concern that the regional meetings are held during the day when the teachers are at work. From what we have heard from our representatives and our members, the majority of those attending the regional meetings were school administrators and school board members. Now, we are interested in knowing how the input from one teacher focus group, which is held tomorrow, will be weighed against the input from the 13 regional meetings that were held throughout the state at a time when our members were not well represented. Since the impact of the Race to the Top application is very likely to fall heavily on the teachers, we would hope that our issues would be taken very seriously. Finally, we strongly urge that Education Minnesota, along with all other stakeholders, has the opportunity to see and comment on the final application before it is submitted. SH Minnesota feels strongly that we need to make sure the decisions that go into Race to the Top are being made for the benefits of Minnesota students and teachers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. I think I'm remembering this correctly, that one of the necessary signatories to the proposal does involve your organization. Is that correct?
It does. And I repeat, we have not taken a formal position on the application itself. And Commissioner Segrin does have a meeting with President Doerr early November. So we are only commenting tonight on the application process.
Thank you very much. Members, we should probably be adjourning here because we're already a half hour past, but are there any thoughts or comments?
These were serious concerns just raised by Education Minnesota, and as far as the time, I would like to hear a moment or two at least, if I could, a response from the Commissioner and the Department of Education concerning Education Minnesota's concerns. These are rather serious questions.
From the AR, but I really would beg us not to do that at this point. It's 9 o'clock, it's late, and I suspect it's going to take longer than 5 minutes to respond, and it should take longer than 5 minutes to respond. We certainly have Representative Growley and myself and Representative Swalwick's ongoing commitment to make sure that we keep vetting this issue, and I trust that the Department will respond directly to any one of us as well as to the chair that we can get back. So I don't want to diminish that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me just say, members, that, you know, in closing that, it seems to me that there is an incredible opportunity here. Whether it'll be a wonderful opportunity or not, you know, it's dependent on a number of issues, some that are outside of the control of even the Department of Education, that are somewhat in control of our federal partners in Washington, D.C. And I hope that as we continue to vet this through, as the Department continues to pursue the grant opportunity, that we can engage with one another in very direct and pointed, tough accountability discussions without folks sort of, you know, picking up their marbles and all going off into their corners. That's how you get good policy. That's how you get good grants. As someone who writes grants for my nonprofit, small nonprofit, I gather my staff around and we challenge each other somewhat like we did a little bit tonight, and we wind up with a better proposal almost always. And so I hope that we continue to have meaningful engagement across the executive and the legislative branch. I do think it was a major unforgivable error on the part of the federal government to find no formal role for the legislative branch. But nonetheless, I trust that at the end, all players involved, the executive branch and the legislative branch, understand that any meaningful reform here is only going to happen if there is broad ownership across both of the House, the Senate, and the Executive Branch, and across Minnesota as well. And so I hope that that's the spirit that we continue to have, this exploration, this discussion. I would invite members to continue to weigh in with the Department of Education directly, and look forward to further hearing on this matter in the months to come. So with that, thank you all for your patience and for being here tonight, and this meeting is adjourned.